Won't be long and the day will be here to honor, exalt, toast, and revere the ladies who shared a chromosome and are famous for Wait Till Your Father Gets Home. Yes, I probably won't see you on Sunday, so an early happy Mother's Day to all who fit that glass slipper. And by the way, thanks. We couldn't do it without you. Welcome to Spectrum West, everybody. What a program this week. The music of Andrew Wallace, a young guy who leads a marvelous big band. They're playing the Phipps Center in Hudson Saturday night. The following Saturday evening, the Pablo Center in Eau Claire will be busy. The Jamp Theater welcomes Iron Boy and Friends. It's Native American drums, dancing, and a flair for the contemporary and collaboration. You've seen him at the Eau Claire Festival, and member Dylan Jennings, a Wisconsin product, will be here. Jim Oliver spends time with the legendary author Jerry Apps, who's given us so much Wisconsin history within pages of his dozens of books, the newest about an intergovernment partnership that actually worked very well. And getting back to the Pablo Center being busy next Saturday is where we begin. The Chippewa Valley Symphony Orchestra hits the RCU Theater to complete its first Pablo Center season, and what a sensation it has been. Special guest after special guest in memorable performances this year, and the final one is no exception. It's entitled In Dynamic Company. Music director Nobu Yasuda paid us a visit. You enter the season with excited anticipation. You even daydreamed and visualized appearing on a stage someday, mm-hmm. a new stage. Now, with this concert, you will have appeared as a symphony orchestra 6 times, including the opening gala. Mm-hmm. Has the season lived up to everything you anticipated, maybe more?
Yeah, actually, the season has been really blessed, I mean, in my opinion. I still remember the day, preparing for the opening concert of the Pablo Center. Mm-hmm. Concert was September 22nd, but we actually went into the hall, probably it was Wednesday, 3 days before the concert, tech rehearsal. Well, then we had a dress rehearsal. Yeah, we were on stage. I personally felt like, am I in a dream or what? So in a way, we were in a dream because the house means the concert hall was our dream. So we were in the dream, right?
Yeah, that's true.
And basically, the orchestra musician actually on the chairs and everybody's, ready to play, rehearse. And I said, we are here now. That was the first thing I said. I remember that. And everybody was just kind of smiling. Yes, we are here. To me, just playing in the gorgeous hall. Uh-huh, uh-huh. It's just, we feel so good. We appreciate the acoustics. It's very easy to hear each other. Mm-hmm, so it's mm-hmm. very easy to play. And also the audience, always, telling us after the concert, oh, everything is beautiful, it's clean.
You've contended, even before the Pablo Center, mm-hmm. that the symphony was growing musically in recent years. So this season had to be another shot of adrenaline for that upward movement.
Our idea, of having this new performing mm-hmm. arts center was that, we could showcase other community groups with us, so mm-hmm. collaboration. So we have been doing that, like a December concert, we collaborated with the Chippewa Valley Jazz Orchestra.
That was fun.
Right, and also, not necessarily, March concert was actually collaborated with anybody, but we had Mark Kasawar, principal cello of Cleveland Orchestra, but it's not just that. He's our native Eau Claire person. So, yeah, we provided the homecoming, great musician. I feel that because of this wonderful hall, our door is open to the world. International level of artists can come to perform with us. Uh-huh. We can invite the first-rate soloist to perform with us. For example, next season, gold medalist and also silver medalist of international music competitions.
Ah.
Yeah, so like, for example, Bill Brahms, piano concerto No. 2. This piece also has been asked for many, many years because, we had a state theater. There was a piano.
Yeah.
But I knew to do that Brahms No. 2 piano concerto, you cannot just do it. You have to have this really good acoustics in the concert hall and a good piano. And then we are able to really invite the first class. Otherwise, the result is not going to be great. Now we are really ready.
Yeah.
We have the hall. We have an orchestra. I really feel like the door is open to the world.
And they have a heck of a piano now.
Yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying.
It's a long piano.
First class.
Yes. Yes, yeah. It is. Nobu's with us. He's the music director and conductor of the Chippewa Valley Symphony Orchestra. Their final concert of a big season is Saturday, the 18th, Pablo Center. It's called In Dynamic Company. This last concert features a whole lot of guest artists. It's a culmination. The way I've written it here, it's a human crescendo of the season. So before all that, the concert on the 18th begins with some Beethoven and some Tchaikovsky. And then we'll talk about Carl Orff, who I'm not familiar with. So the Beethoven and Tchaikovsky, what are we going to hear there?
Oh, Beethoven Egmont Overture. It's a very, very powerful overture. It's not too long. Beethoven, you know, had a strong will. He was a kind of a humanist. During the time, European countries were, you know, basically dominated by rich people. So Beethoven's idea was, you know, the middle-class people has to rise up. This Egmont Overture, it's kind of a, you know, capture that kind of liberation, this kind of spirit. So that's Beethoven, right. And we are playing also Tchaikovsky 1812 Overture. Probably you know this piece. Quite often, sure. You know, being performed at the July 4th concert with a real canon.
Yes.
Of course, you know, we cannot use canon, you know, inside the Pablo Center because it's a new concert hall. We don't want to destroy it.
You know, you don't want to do that. So what do you use? Just timpani?
Well, you come and you see, you have to come to find out.
We set up a teaser there. Good for us.
It's not just timpani. We're not going to just do timpani.
Oh, good, good, good. Now you've made me want to.
I know. It's something you're going to, whoa!
Ever the salesman, Nobu. Carl Orff. Carl Orff. Who's Carl Orff? Why don't I know him?
Orff is he's actually known as a composer, so also a music educator.
Contemporary?
No, he was active 1930s, 40s, and in Germany. But this Carl Orff's Carmina Burana became basically his signature. But at the same time, once you hear the opening chord, I mean, I cannot sing on the opening chord because, you know, chord has to have a few multi notes. I have only one voice. Yes. I cannot say that. But it's when you hear it, that one, everybody knows.
Oh, really?
In many, many popular movies, it's called O Fortuna. O Fortuna was used in many, many movies.
It appears to me as if this piece is meant to be sensational, though, in the fact that you have all these singers and you have a choir. Is it written for that, or you've just embellished it, or what?
No. This is written for, you know, big choir and big orchestra, two pianos, and three soloists.
My. Mm-hmm. What are the soloists going to be playing?
They sing, actually, part of the...
Oh, these are...
Song.
They're all singers?
Yeah, song, tenor, baritone, soprano.
Oh, okay. The guest artists are all vocalists.
Right. It's a part of the piece.
It is.
Right. Sometimes, actually, choir comes in. Sometimes, soloist. Some actually texts appropriate for big chorus, and some texts are, you know, kind of appropriate to be sung by one individual person.
And it says a full performance of Carl Orff's masterpiece. That means what? That it's lengthy, or that it just involves a ton of people? A full performance.
Sometimes, you know, they perform just a part of this Carmina Burana.
The familiar part.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But we are doing the complete version. It's about 1 hour long.
Wow, so that's the whole second half?
Mm-hmm. But more than anything, actually, I'm very pleased we were able to form this Chippewa Valley Festival Choir.
Yes.
Yeah, so this choir members kind of coming from many different choirs.
Okay.
You know, because, you know, we have a very rich choir tradition in the community.
Yes. Who's coordinating all the vocals?
His name is Jerry Wee. He's a
He's from Stout.
Stout, yeah. He's excellent. Nice person.
Is he?
Yeah, talented, actually.
I've spoken to him several times. I just never have met him in person.
Very nice guy. Yeah, it's not just nice guy, but he's so excited. I approached a few directors to be able to form this choir. Mm-hmm. Because I'm an orchestra guy, and I don't really understand forming a choir. When I met him, you know, I told him about this project, and he was so excited. Oh, so that energy really gave me the kind of, how do I say that? When you meet somebody, your instinct tell you that, we can make a great team.
Sure.
You know, it's not like I ask him, no, we have to be a good team.
I think that's what you said the first time you met me.
Yeah.
Isn't that right?
Mm-hmm.
I saw it in your eyes. You may not have said it, but.
It's going to be 80 exciting, you know, singers. They have been already rehearsing. I was at the rehearsal 4 times. Mm. You know, I'm so happy the way, you know, the choir rehearsal is going. Yeah, because, you know, after the rehearsal, you know, everybody's, oh, this is fun. Oh, this is great. And, you know, sometimes, you know, rehearsal can be very, very hard.
Arduous,
and,
yeah.
Like sometimes, you know, you feel like, oh, I don't want to do this. But everybody's so happy. And yeah, so then also they are really excited about singing with, you know, orchestra in the Pablo Center.
Do they sing in English?
Nope. It's a Latin, old Latin, German Latin, and also old German. It's great.
Because Jerry, I know, is he leads some very Baroque.
Renaissance kind of choir, right.
Yeah. He likes that old stuff. He's good at it.
But. Yeah, this is actually an orchestra piece, but in a style of Renaissance.
Okay.
However, style of Renaissance, you know, how the melodies, you know, goes, but it's an incredibly huge symphonic piece.
It is.
I want people to come. Really, this is amazing. I mean, this is the conclusion of the, you know, season, Confluence, right?
How does it compare to doing Mahler?
Yeah, it's like a Mahler.
It is?
Yeah, it is like a Mahler.
Because I know you were excited about that.
Right.
Well, we're all excited about the final concert of the season, and we're even more excited about learning all the surprises coming up in our next season, and we'll have Nobu back to do that prior to the beginning of next season. The final concert of the 44th season of the Chippewa Valley Symphony Orchestra is Saturday, May 18th, Pablo Center. It's called In Dynamic Company. Let's underscore the word dynamic. Thanks, Nobu, for coming in, as usual.
Thank you very much.
Yes, PabloCenter.org is the place to go for tickets. We're all looking forward to it. Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. So good to have you along. Support for WPR comes from Art Z Gallery in Amory, presenting An Exploration of Art, featuring watercolors by Bonnie Hagen, photography by Tony Small, and jewelry by Sheila Quartz. More information is at artzgallery.com. Here's a Spectrum memo for you. Don't forget the Big River Radio Wave comes to the Big River Theater in Alma next Sunday, the 19th. 2 shows, 5 and 7 p.m., recorded for broadcast on July 4th, so you can celebrate Independence Day early. Get it out of the way. Special guests, River Falls poet Thomas R. Smith, cellist Ed Willett, comedian Amber Preston, and the music of John Smith, Dan Sobranek, and Larry Dalton. BigRiverTheater.com is the website. Hey, you know, Jerry Apps is a favorite son of WPR, WPT, and the first name of each, Wisconsin. He's done as much as anyone in our state's history to preserve the past within books that are favorites on many a household bookshelf. Every media person should have the opportunity to interview Jerry, simply because it means you'll read at least one of his books, and after that happens, you'll probably read them all. He's written about the CCC now. If you're old enough, you know what that is. If not, you're about to understand. Here's Jim Oliver. Jerry Apps, who was born and raised on a Wisconsin farm, is professor emeritus at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the author of more than 35 books, many of them on rural history and country life. His book, The Civilian Conservation Corps in Wisconsin, Nature's Army at Work, was published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press this past March. Jerry, thanks so much for coming on to talk to us. Welcome to Spectrum West.
Always glad to do it.
Well, how did this book come about?
I was attending a book fair in Minneapolis, talking with different people, and there happened to be the owner of a bookstore in Wausau, Jane Yonke Johnson was her name. She mentioned to me, have you ever thought about writing a book about the CCC? Well, no, because I always have several projects that I'm working on. Well, she said, you ought to think about doing that. There are just a bunch of folks who have family or who knew someone who was in the CCC, and I think they would be interested in reading it. My books have all kinds of interesting beginnings. That was the beginning of the CCC book.
How was the CCC started? Department of Agriculture, Department of Labor, Department of Interior, and the War Department. How did they all get together to put together this?
That is really a very interesting question. The CCC was one of several organizations that Franklin D. Roosevelt, who was elected in 1932 and came on board in 1933, in the midst of the Great Depression, when we had as much as 25% unemployment in the country, and Roosevelt knew something had to happen. So he quickly offered to the Congress an idea, a bill, to create an organization to put especially young men who were unemployed to work. Roosevelt had some experience with conservation projects and had an interest in them from his days in New York State. In 1933, the legislation was passed by the Congress creating the CCC. Passed in March, and believe it or not, by April, the first CCC camp was already in operation. It was a kind of a political miracle that something should happen, that anything could happen that quickly between the president and the Congress, but it did. The second thing, unbelievable to people, was that it created an organization that asked, as you just mentioned, four different organizations that, by and large, never even talked to each other. Can you imagine the War Department talking to the United States Department of Agriculture? It wasn't happening. But this bill, this law, said that that will happen. And so this very unique organization called the Civilian Conservation Corps was born. The critics said it cannot work. It worked. And it was one of the most successful programs of the New Deal, as FDR's programs were called, to see the light of day.
You know, I remember being in grade school in the late 1940s. There was always jokes made about the WPA, the Works Progress Administration.
Right.
It was called Wee Poke Along, was the call.
Exactly.
And you never heard that about the CCC.
It was you didn't. And there were critics. The Chicago Tribune was a critic of Roosevelt, anything that he had come up with. But they changed their minds along the way. Some 250,000 young men were involved in this program.
Wow.
And by definition, they had to come from families who were on welfare, a different language in those days. Can you believe this? They received $30 a month, and $25 of that $30 they had to return to their parents.
Hmm.
Can you imagine now?
Wow. Yeah.
These young men are working for $5 a month.
Hmm.
And believe it or not, I talked to a few. There are a few still living. I read lots of records. I found almost no hesitation to do that, to receive that little bit of money, because, number one, he had something to eat, and very good eating, and he had a roof over his head. And in those days, in the 1930s, those two attributes, something to eat and a roof over your head, were scarce commodities for more people than we ever would like to remember.
Hmm. Well, they had to be on welfare. What were some of the other things that hoops
yeah, well,
participants
here,
had to jump
here
through?
Here are the wrinkles now. That if you wanted to be a part of it, let's say you're a young, unemployed young fellow, you had to then go to the local Department of Labor office. They had to check out the family to make sure that they were not doing well and all the rest of it. Once the young man was accepted, the first thing he had to do in terms of a hoop to jump through, they sent them to various army camps in Wisconsin. Many of the candidates went to Fort Sheridan in Illinois for physical training. And sometimes that was 2 weeks, 3 weeks, maybe longer than that, because these young men, having had no work, were badly out of shape. After that, they were assigned to a camp someplace in the United States. And the camps were the responsibility of the U.S. Army, which just bothered some people no end. How in the world could you call an organization the Civilian Conservation Corps when the Army was in charge of the camp? Which sounds like a major contradiction, and it is. And there were Army officers in charge of these camps, and they helped get them constructed. They brought in their mess sergeants. The camp was under the control of the U.S. Army. The field work, however, if they were in soil conservation or if they were in reforestation, park improvement, those were supervised by those various agencies. If you were working on soil conservation, it was the Soil Conservation Service. If you were working in park restoration, in the Department of Interior. Forestry, it was the Department of Agriculture. On paper, it was an impossible organization. This cannot work, but it did.
Sure did. He is Jerry Apps, who is author of the book The Civilian Conservation Corps in Wisconsin. Talk a little bit about what life was like in a CCC camp.
Well, a camp consisted of about 200 people. Let's say 175 of them were young men. And then we've got the Army officers, and then we've got the supervisors. There were about 40 young men in a building, in a barracks. Let's say they were in a camp up north someplace. And we had 125 of them in Wisconsin, as a matter of fact, all over the state. And let's say it's January and it's 10 below zero and you're up at the crack of dawn. You have a big breakfast and then you're off into the woods. They were clearing out popple, aspen, second growth after the loggers came in. By the way, they, as an aside, were some of the earliest, without them, I suspect, even knowing it, some of the earliest environmentalists, because they were cleaning up, in quotes, what was left behind by the logging barons who raped the North, mm-hmm. to put it bluntly.
Yeah.
So they would be off clearing the aspen so that they could then plant trees. So they would work till noon, and if they were close enough to walk back to the dining hall, then they would have a noon meal. And then in the evening, sometimes a 40 below zero, they got a stove on each end of this of this barracks. And wet socks hanging around. Can you imagine just to walk in the place to what it would smell like? Jeez. I mean, just think about that. And so they would work 5 days a week. And Saturday they would have off. And one of the fun things, I got some pictures, is they did their wash their clothes in a big old tub with a fire under it, something like that, on Saturday. But here's another part of it. Every one of these camps had an education director. And it might be a teacher from the local community who was laid off and not working. And this educator would provide all kinds of educational opportunities. A fair number of these young men were illiterate. They couldn't read or write.
Mm-hmm.
And so there would be an educator that would help them learn to read and write. They might be another person teaching them how to do welding. There might be another person teaching them how to do woodworking. There might be another person just teaching them English. Education was a very important part of the program because the whole idea was help fix the land, soil conservation, reforestation, and so on, but also how to fix the young man, to restore young men.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that point is overlooked, but that was an extremely important point. Several times I read in journals and various kinds of sources where a young man would say, I went into the CCC as a boy, and I came out as a man.
Hmm.
Powerful statement.
Well, I should say. You write that local communities near the camps were pretty positive about the influence of the camps.
Yes. One of the things that CCC organization did well is that they integrated themselves into the community. What did I mean by that? They would hire laid-off people in the community. Carpenters, bricklayers, stonemasons, teachers, skilled people to work with the CCC boys. For example, as you look around Wisconsin, some of the most lasting things that the CCC boys did was to build beautiful buildings at many of our national parks and state parks out of stone. And I'm from Wild Rose, central Wisconsin. The Wild Rose Fish Hatchery has a beautiful wall made out of rock. And it took a stonemason, who I'm sure was the same guy that would help a farmer build his barn wall or a church wall or whatever. He was showing these kids how to build with rock. So another thing they would do, they would invite the community, the local community, to come out to the camp on occasion. They'd have a big dance or a big party. Or in many of the camps, the boys themselves had a little orchestra. Mm. Some of them knew how to play a guitar. Some of them had an accordion and so on. And so they'd have entertainment. They'd entertain themselves, of course, but then they would entertain the community. And then the other way around, most of these camps were located within 4 or 5 miles or less from a community. They'd load them up in trucks, and they'd go into town on Saturday night. The village would sponsor a dance, and the young gals would come in. This became one of the problems, of course.
Yes, that could be.
But they had just had a hi-ho time. Mm-hmm. It was, tell you the truth, I've seen no evidence of any kind of animosity between the local community. For example, if there was a fire in town, the boys would go to town and help fight the fire.
Wow.
They did all kinds of stuff that was that enamored them to the local communities. Mind you now, some of these local communities weren't any larger than the camp itself. The camp had 200 people. I mean, these towns weren't any bigger than that.
Sure. Well, the program ended rather quickly in the grand order of things.
Well, it ended in officially in 1942. But it essentially ended on December 7th, 1941, which is Pearl Harbor Day and the beginning of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the interesting asides, and you got to kind of read between the lines to see this, these young men who had worked in the CCC, nearly all of them ended up in World War II, and they had been prepared to work with the Army. They had been prepared to take orders, prepared to work together as a group. All of that they learned without realizing they were learning it as a part of their involvement in the CCC. And so many, almost all of these young men ended up in World War II.
Well, the book is The Civilian Conservation Corps in Wisconsin. We've been talking to the author, Jerry Apps. The book is available through the publisher, the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. As well, I guess you could get it on most of the online booksellers, or if you go to your neighborhood local bookstore, I'm sure they'd be happy to order it for you.
And most of them have the book already. It's been doing pretty well, I must say.
Oh, glad to hear that. Well, Jerry Apps, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for the opportunity. I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Jim Oliver, ladies and gentlemen, on Spectrum West. As previously expressed, Saturday, May 18th is a busy evening at the Pablo Center in Eau Claire. While the Symphony Orchestra fills the RCU Theater, the Jamp Theater welcomes Iron Boy and friends. If you enjoy the pageantry of Native American drum circles and dance and wondered what it might be like with a contemporary twist, this show is for you. Dylan Jennings lives in Bad River, Wisconsin, and has teamed with others from the Twin Cities to form the core of this talented collective. We spoke on the phone earlier this week. Well, you guys have appeared at the Eau Claire Festival, I read. To those who did not attend that, give me, if you would please, a brief definition of what it is you do, and then I have some specific questions for you.
Yeah, so in our communities, we're known as singers. We're the ones that carry some of the traditions that go along with the powwow drum and with the drum in general. And singers in our communities are very important to the functioning of our societies as indigenous communities. Nowadays, you know, in our spare time, we bring some of that contemporary flair and try to collaborate with artists to bring our sound and our style to kind of the mainstream music festivals and mainstream contemporary music.
I have attended, thankfully so, a powwow or two. The most recent was in Hayward a couple of years ago. And I strongly encourage every American to engage with their Native American brothers and sisters in an event like this. I found it pretty powerful. I found it expressive. I found it educational. I can't say, however, that I came away with a new understanding. I certainly had a new appreciation, but I did, after going, I hungered for more understanding. Is that kind of similar to what you hear from others after you guys perform?
Yeah, I think in general, our songs, our dances, and especially the beat of the drum, which we consider to be the heartbeat of Mother Earth, is a drawing factor. And I believe it draws people in of all races and ethnicities, and it provides a sense of comfort, inquiry, and everything when the drum is out and being utilized and our dancers are dancing. It provides a level of healing, too, that people probably don't even realize.
What I read about you guys listed you as an original-style Native American drum group, and as you said, with a contemporary flair. Now, given the fact that so much of your culture is based on tradition and passing it on. Then the words original style and contemporary flair kind of stand out to me. Was there a debate going on in your head at the beginning about whether or not original and contemporary would clash with tradition, or did you decide that it was a great way to introduce some things to new audiences?
I think, you know, definitely there are limitations to what kinds of traditional things you can bring into the mainstream and kind of contemporize. But I think for the most part, our goal as singers in our communities is to help revitalize everything that has been lost. One way to do that is to make it more appealing to some of our younger audiences and mainstream audiences and, you know, combine it with contemporary music and add our flair to it.
I'm curious what you learned from your mothers and fathers and grandmothers and grandfathers. How was your heritage passed to your generation? And the toughest part must be making sure that it does not get diluted with each new generation.
Goal number one of mine is to make sure that children in our community and my children especially speak our languages and practice our ways of life. I was very fortunate to be handed down a great deal of our practices, our harvesting practices, and our traditional way of life. Language was always a very big thing in our family, too, and it's very important for us to preserve all of those things because intertwined with our culture and our way of life is our language and everything that goes along with our identity as Indigenous communities.
We're on the phone with Dylan Jennings. He's a member of Iron Boy and Friends.
Iron Boy is the drum group, and Bija Key is the name of the dance group or the okay. overall or overarching organized group that kind of sets a lot of this up.
Okay. They're all appearing at the Pablo Center Saturday, May 18th, 7:30 p.m. in the Jamp Theater. You know, getting back to the fact that I had been to a powwow or two, the other thing I didn't mention, after I left it, I was a bit jealous because your culture seemed to have a far more meaningful occasion, and many of our holidays and celebrations today are diluted, to use that word again, and kind of predictable. So I wish that we had more of the authenticity and the heritage involved like you guys do. But you work hard to make sure that that's an ingredient.
Absolutely. And I think what you'll find is many of our tribal communities, you know, across Wisconsin especially and throughout the United States are very open and accepting and willing to share all that we have to the benefit of everybody. So we're very, very much excited and pleased to share our song and dance.
I know that there is choreography involved in what you do. In other words, it's rehearsed and it's a program, but I'm guessing that maybe there is some spontaneity and some improvising.
Absolutely, especially when we've been asked to go to some of these music festivals. You know, literally artists will just come up and be like, hey, we want to do something with you guys. We don't know what it is we want to do, but we want to play some music. We want to make music, and we're all about that, trying new things and seeing how our beats can meld together and our songs can meld together.
I'm going to guess, Dylan, that young audiences are probably spellbound by what you do, and I'm talking the young ones, the grade schoolers. But it is, of course, future generations who are going to matter if we're going to further our understanding of one another. You do have a very educational side of what you do. You perform in schools, and you have workshops, plus things like the ecology are also part of your message.
Those are all very important, passionate subjects of our group, and we firmly believe that without the environment, we wouldn't be here. And so a lot of our dances and songs even reflect that, the mm-hmm. importance of our environment, the importance of our way of life and how that's all tied together. So there's no separation from those in the way that we perceive and the way that our mindset works.
I haven't seen you guys perform, but I can imagine you having a rather hands-on experience. Does that happen?
Yeah, I think we try to do that with the majority of the audiences we work with. We okay. want to get them up. We want to get them dancing. We want to get them feeling that music. So that's what it's about for us.
What about the logistics of your group? You know, you live in Bad River, Wisconsin. A lot of your members are Twin Cities people. How do you guys get together, and how often are you able to get together, and do you have to get together on a regular basis to put together new stuff?
Yeah, we get together quite a bit. You know, sometimes we're booked to travel. Sometimes we're scheduled to go be at a powwow somewhere, and other times we have other types of gigs that we perform at. And so Sometimes there's slow times of the year where we're all just super busy with, you know, more individualized things, and we just come back together as one group and, you know, kind of pick up where we left off.
Now, having been to those powwows, I know what a drum circle is, and you guys take that to a new level. I'm trying to imagine what it is you do on stage. Do you have the traditional types of things, like the drum circle that I was looking at online, and then what? You embellish it with some electronics? Do you have some guitars, keyboards? What do you have?
Yeah, it really depends on the show and, you know, which one of our good chums and friends can make it, but every show is different. And we kind of leave that up to the specific venue, so I don't want to share a whole lot about what you'll find at Eau Claire in the Pablo Center, but it'll be exciting in a pretty cool way.
Good for you, yeah. I'm glad that you lived up to the salesmanship there, because the line that I read said, join Iron Boy and Friends for an evening of music, dance, and here comes what you just gave us, the unexpected.
Yep.
Good for you.
That's what we like to do.
Well, we're excited for your visit. You'll be in the same building with a symphony concert that night. This is going to test the acoustic integrity of the new Pablo Center. I've been in the Pablo Center where there were two performances going on at once. You can't tell. That's neat. It's kind of a cultural exchange in itself, an evening of a symphony orchestra concert and Iron Boy and Friends in the jam.
Yeah, and who knows? Maybe we just need to improv and jam out with the symphony too, you know.
Boy, I can just imagine. They love to collaborate with people. Has a Native American group, drum circle, and or dance troupe performed with a symphony?
Yeah, I've actually seen it happen a couple of times, and I got to tell you, it's pretty amazing.
Oh, I bet. Dylan Jennings, thanks for being with us on Wisconsin Public Radio, and we're looking forward to you getting back here to Eau Claire. Travel safely.
Well, Miigwech, thanks for having us, and we'll see you next weekend.
Miigwech, there you go. Got a new word. Iron Boy and Friends, and I think friends will include everyone in the audience as well. Next Saturday, the 18th, 7:30 p.m., tickets, pablocenter.org. Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio, where support for WPR comes from the Chippewa Valley Symphony Orchestra. A full choir joins the orchestra for the season finale concert featuring Carmina Burana, May 18th, 7:30 p.m. at the Pablo Center at the Confluence. Again, pablocenter.org is the website. Spectrum memo for you, Hillcrest Pottery, the home of stoneware artist Willem Gebben, has its 31st annual spring sale Saturday from 10 to 4. Also, oil paintings and prints by Jordis Olson. It's a mile south of Highway 40 on County Road A, that is near Colfax, Wisconsin. The Tropo Big Band Jazz Orchestra performs at the Ladysmith High School Auditorium Saturday at 7:30 p.m., the final event in the Flambeau Valley Arts Association 47th performance season. Congratulations. Well, some theater seasons are starting, others are winding down. Here again is Jim Oliver with Who's Who and What's What.
Mamma Mia will be presented by the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild through Sunday in the Jamp Theater in the Pablo Center at the Confluence. The Northern Star Theater of Rice Lake will present The 100 Dresses Friday through Sunday. Oli Plays Nursemaid will be presented Monday at the Heidi Center for the Arts in Chippewa Falls. Musical Adventures of Flat Stanley Jr. will be performed by the Phipps Children's Theater Friday through Sunday at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. Peter Pan will be presented by the Old Gem Theater weekdays beginning Monday and continuing through June 7th. The show will be open to public audiences May 16th through the 19th. The Eau Claire Children's Theater will present A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder May 16th through the 19th at the Oxford Theater. And the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater in Hudson is presenting Honky Tonk Laundry Fridays and Saturdays through May 18th. For Spectrum West, I'm Jim Oliver.
She gets hungry for dinner at 8. Loves the theater, but she never goes there late. She'd never bother people that she hates. That's why Lady is a Tramp.
Well, once again, this job just got bigger and better. I learned about more fine makers of music and heard about new places at which to hear them and others. I call it the ever-expanding Spectrum West Horizon. Come Saturday, the main stage at the Phipps Center in Hudson will be adorned with the musicians of the Andrew Wallace Big Band and the seats filled with people who came to relive 100 years of Sinatra. Andrew Wallace wasn't around during the years most of those hits were becoming so, but he lives it just the same. First, I have to congratulate you on using the word insouciance in a sentence. You don't see that word. That word doesn't jump off the dictionary page very often.
Well, thank you.
It's in your bio on your website. I'll let people look that up. I have to say that this whole conversation feels good to me because we lately have been on a real jazz and big bandy kick. The Big Eau Claire Jazz Festival was just a couple weeks ago, and that gets huger every year. And I got to see three very good and renowned trombone players last Saturday night with a jazz orchestra, so kind of still in a groove.
Yeah.
I always want to hear about a person's affair with music. You're not an old guy. How did young St. Cloud, Minnesota, Andrew fall and discover a reverence for, as we used to call it, middle-of-the-road music?
I like that term, first of all.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's a question that gets asked of me all the time. How did you fall into this music, into jazz and big band and swing? Where did that come from? It must have been your parents. It must have been your grandparents. And the truth is, none of those are the case. My parents were never into this kind of music. My grandparents listened to country music and old-time music. So I really discovered this music kind of on my own. I was listening to a soundtrack of the movie Sleepless in Seattle. And I think the first time that I heard Louis Armstrong, I was just enchanted. I just remember thinking, what is this? And how do I get my hands on it? And how do I hear more of it? It was really my love affair initially with Louis Armstrong, and then that eloped into Ella Fitzgerald, and then that eloped into Frank Sinatra and all of the great singers of the 50s and 60s who really are still all of my idols. So I started going to the public library. Thank God for libraries and the library system. Of course, they had a very extensive collection of jazz and big band CDs. And at that time, of course, it was a CD world.
Sure.
And so I took all of these CDs and loaded them into my iTunes on my computer. I sort of archived a lot of this music from the library, got my hands on every single record that I could of that era. I just couldn't get enough.
So how old was the young Andrew when this happened? And were you already an instrumentalist and a vocalist when you discovered all this stuff and just switched gears?
Well, this all started, I suppose, when I was maybe 11 or 12 years old. I was always a singer. I grew up singing, actually, in the St. John's Boys Choir. That was my first foray into music. So that started when I was probably 8 or 9 years old. I was singing in the St. John's Boys Choir. So I was a singer first. Ella Fitzgerald was, I think, my first love in the jazz tradition. I just thought her instrument and her approach was so exquisite and so flawless. Not until I was about 16, actually, did I sit down at the piano, which people think is really kind of funny because a lot of people think of me as just as much of a pianist as a singer now.
Mm-hmm.
But that came much later when I realized that to be a working singer, work clubs and do shows, I was going to have to hire somebody to play with me. So I realized I could either sit down and start figuring out how to play the piano myself, or I would have to find somebody to do that for me and give them at least half of the money. So one day I just sat down, I suppose I was 16 years old, 17, something like that, and just started plunking away and kind of figuring out how to accompany myself.
Yeah, you're kind of a do-it-yourself guy, aren't you?
I think so. I've always believed that music is, I think a lot of musicians would agree with this, the ear is always ahead of your ability. So you can always hear what you want to do before you can actually do it. So it's sort of this game of playing catch-up with what you can hear and what you can actually do.
You prepared yourself. You soaked in all this music and all of these icons. When did you get to this confident point I've been singing this long. I taught myself to play the piano. I think I could put a big band together, which requires a serious mixture of music and some business talent at the same time, I would think.
It definitely takes some organizational acumen, because every time you do a gig, of course, you have to, of course, nowadays in the world of email, it's easier. I can't imagine my predecessors that had to make 17 phone calls every time they, you know, booked a show to get the band together. But it's still a lot of work with the emailing as 17, 18 people. After I graduated from St. John's in about 2010,
okay,
I had a 18-piece big band, and I did a show with a friend of mine called Frank and Nat, which was the music of Frank Sinatra and Nat King Cole.
Mm-hmm.
That was my sort of initial foray into having a big band, and I accumulated a bunch of charts. I bought a whole bunch of big band charts on the internet. And then a couple of years later, I met a friend who is in this current band, which will be with me at the FIPS, Bob Parsons. And Bob is from St. James, Minnesota, but spent many, many years in New York teaching music at NYU. He's an incredible arranger. So he actually wrote all of the arrangements for this band custom for this ensemble. This is a very tight 10-piece group. We have 6 horns, 3 saxes, 2 trumpets, and a trombone, bass, drums, guitar, and I play piano and sing. These charts are extremely well-crafted and written especially for me and for this ensemble, so that's really quite a treat.
In the wee small hours of the morning, while the whole wide world is fast asleep, you lie awake and think about the girl. Never ever think of counting sheep.
On the phone with Andrew Wallace, he's a singer and a pianist and the leader of a big band. They're coming Saturday, 7:30 p.m. for 100 Years of Sinatra, name of the show, at the Phipps Center for the Arts. That is in Hudson. Some of the most wonderful performances and arrangements can be found in the most obscure places, like old dusty 78s. You already admitted that you are an audiophile of some sorts. Is listening part of what you continue to enjoy? Are you always looking for new stuff to interpret? Because I understand you like to interpret lyrics as well, and singing style, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. My favorite thing to collect is LPs from the 50s and 60s, because okay, this was a very special time in music when there were really great arrangers, and they were hired to write for really great singers, and there were these big, lush studio orchestras. So great songwriters wrote great songs arranged by great arrangers and then interpreted by wonderful singers. This was an incredible time in music, mid-1950s into the early 60s. My favorite thing to do is to find old songs, old gems from those records done in that period that have sort of been left behind, because there was such a bevy of great material.
I love the fact that so many collegiate music programs are making sure that, well, even backwards to high school, there's a lot of jazz programs, a lot of jazz bands in high school nowadays. Some of the collegiate bands, absolutely fabulous. Good for them.
Benny Golson was just at Crooner's, this club in Minneapolis, wonderful club, and he's 90 years old, and I had an opportunity to watch 2 of his shows there, and he told me, when I was a kid coming up playing the sax, we couldn't go to college for this music, for jazz. We couldn't go study it in schools. And now that's an option for people. And like you were just saying, be a part of these wonderful collegiate bands and orchestras playing jazz. America's great music is what I call it. It's a wonderful thing.
The Phipps, your Phipps performance Saturday night is on Mother's Day Eve.
That's right.
And who better to excite the ladies than Sinatra?
And indeed, yes.
You have to be somewhere at 10 o'clock in the morning on Mother's Day. Boy, you're a busy guy.
Yes, I'm very fortunate to be very busy performing it's funny because in January, a lot of performers will tell you this, you have, you know, 2-3 weeks where you're not really doing a whole lot of anything. And then you hit your busy season and you're working, you know, 10, 14, sometimes more days in a row. The work is not steady, but, you know, you got to make hay while the sun shines. So we all in this business, when we get good shows and good opportunities, we take those opportunities, and oftentimes they come all at one time, and that's okay. I saw a show at the Phipps years ago, and I'm so excited to be having the opportunity to perform there. What a beautiful space that is.
It is, yeah. It's a wonderful...
Just a wonderful venue.
People of Hudson are fortunate. It's good to see that your haystack is getting taller. You're making lots of hay. Good for you. Thanks for spending time with our WPR audience.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
I got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow, got the string around my finger. What a world, what a life, I'm in love. I got a song that I sing, I can make the rain go anytime I move my finger. Lucky me, can't you see I'm in love? Life's a wonderful thing, as long as I've got that string. I'd be a silly so-and-so if I should ever let it go. I got the world.
Well, I wish I could tell you that you could get tickets, but it's sold out Saturday night at the Phipps Center. But you have the luxury of following the Andrew Walesch Big Band. It's WALESCH. And, you know, when he and they play again other places, you can be there. I'm going to. Sure does sound like a lot of fun. At the Heidi Center, the rescheduled performance by Blue Jupiter, a fabulous a cappella quartet from New York, is Friday. CVCA.net is that website. Writers Read is holding an open mic at the Ellie Phillips Library in Eau Claire tonight, if you're listening on Thursday. It starts at 6 p.m. It's going to celebrate the summer travel season, so bring a travel-themed story or poem, 5 minutes or less. Coming up next week, this is going to be fun, Charlie Parr and Phil Cook together are going to combine. It should be a lot of fun because they're performing together in Eau Claire shortly. There's a comedy troupe called Asperger's or Us. That's more than enough to whet one's appetite for more right there. And more on next week's show. Thanks, Erica, Dean, and Kate. Thank you guys for being in the audience. Every show needs to survive. To hear this or any past program, go to WPR.org. You can click on Shows, then Spectrum West, find the date, download, or listen away. I'm Al Ross for Jim Oliver. Thank you again. See you next week.